welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love, and we are going to talk about a podcast favorite topic. Give everybody a moment to pause, run through in your head what you think that might be. Dun, dun, dun. Today's special guest is Deputy Director of Streetcar Services, Lori Burchett. She's actually pretty new. The streetcar has a lot of energy around it these days. Ridership numbers are hitting all-time highs. We get lots of press releases about, you know, all of these records it's setting. And so she's been on the job like 6 months, 8 months, and we thought we would sit down with her and talk all things streetcar.
How far we have come. If we have any longtime listeners that remember the launch of the That's So Cincinnati podcast with Paul Daner Jr. and Jason Williams.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about it so much that they tried to ban it. Like, we can't talk about this anymore. We talk about it too much. And then one of them would bring it up. I don't know if they had a fine jar, like, you know, a swear jar or whatever. But it was that controversial in the beginning.
Now, and we wrote about it all the time. I'm better off for not talking about it every day of my life and writing about it every day of my life.
So I'm very excited, eager to talk about what is the streetcar's mission now. Now that, you know, it's been built, the controversy over even building it in the first place, everybody's had to move on. They've made some changes. The whole city has changed. So we're going to find out from the person who knows best, what is the streetcar up to these days?
And I promise we'll ask the number one question on everybody's mind. Is it going to expand or not?
All right. All right. But we've also had a busy news week with another favorite topic of ours on the podcast, and that is corruption in City Hall.
We did this week, finally, I almost put that in the headline in parentheses, finally, the third council person charged with federal corruption pleaded guilty in court. And it was Jeff Pastor. He pleaded guilty to one charge of honest service wire fraud, really encompassing the whole scheme he's accused of.
And now has pled guilty of.
He has pled guilty of, yes. And so we did hear that he is facing up to 24 months in prison. Although he himself, he can ask for probation. The whole sentencing process starts now. It's kind of a long process. There's not even a date set. So we don't know what the sentence will be. But he did plead guilty.
And for those who don't remember the background, in his particular case, he was pretty aggressive with approaching developers and who he thought were developers. That ended up being undercover FBI agents.
Yes, they did.
Directly asking for cash, compensation tied to his vote, basically selling his vote on development projects in the city, you know, wanting to get consulting fees, wanting to get, you know, thousands of dollars here, thousands of dollars there.
I mean, he wanted a salary. Right out of the gate.
It was pretty brazen.
It was very, the most brazen of the three.
I agree. Compared to P.G. Sittenfeld, who is still awaiting
sentencing.
His sentencing.
I don't know if everybody wants to know this, but I start my day every day by looking at the federal court system to see if any sentencing dates have been set. It's like become a thing.
In P.G.'s case, through the testimony, we learned that these were conversations about contributing to his political campaign. Mm-hmm. At one point, he even said, you know, I'm a pro-developer elected official. As long as what we are doing here, everybody understands it's not quid pro quo. I mean, he did. You know, so now you can argue all day long about whether that was a systemic problem that he just leveraged or was it an outright you know, crossing the line when it comes to selling his vote, selling his influence, but not so much in the Pastor case. This was truly tied to someone wanting to
enrich himself
financially, leverage, you know, in ways that are not legal his position as a Cincinnati city councilman.
I mean, he took a trip with these, you know, undercover FBI agent pretend developers. He took a trip with them to Miami on a plane. There were boats. We've heard in the past they visited a strip club. They didn't say that sexy detail during court yesterday, but we did hear that. And that honestly, like that, just on its face value is a no-go. And during P.G. Sittenfeld's trial, we heard several times that P.G. was asked to go on trips by these same developers and kind of like a different scheme that was happening. And P.G. always said no. He had excuses. I can't go. Because P.G. knew you can't take a trip with developers. That's not okay.
Right. I think it's fair to say P.G. knew where the line was. And maybe he tiptoed across it, you know, from time to time.
To be fair, the jury said that he did.
Exactly. Now he's appealing.
Well, he had post-trial motions, which were denied by the judge. The judge said, no, you did cross the line. And so now it's sentencing. I'm sure there'll be appeals later.
But more to come with PG. Uh-huh. This was not a case of flirting with the line in the pastor case.
No,
this
was not. There's accusations of the setting up of the because he's a co-defendant who's one of his friends and he is not sentenced yet or anything. So setting up of this fake charity to sanitize, you know, in quotes there, the money that would flow into just his personal coffers. Like he knew that's wrong. That's wrong. He knew it.
And, you know, from the beginning with Jeff Pastor, there were questions, you know, someone bought him a house that he lived in. So the question was, well, you know, why is someone buying you a house? Did you work for them? You know, when you are an elected official, any gift, any cash, any here's a house comes into question because of influence. And so this is something that has dogged him. You know, throughout his term as a public servant. And so now we have two of the three have we can close the book on because you have Tamaya Dennard. She has served time.
Well, we do need Jeff still to be sentenced.
Jeff will be sentenced, but he has pled. So, you know, they accepted the guilty verdict or the guilty plea. And now it's just a matter of will he do time? Will he be allowed to be on probation? The remaining shoe of the three shoes that need to drop now is P.G. Sittenfeld. And we don't have any idea, do we, Sherry, of when that sentencing is supposed to be?
We are getting very close to finding out. You know, a pre-sentencing report, and the judge called it this yesterday, was explaining to Jeff what it would be. They do a report that's everything about your life that's ever happened. It is a very comprehensive report. It is for the report. It is for the judge's eyes only. Things about these pre-sentencing reports do cut some parts of them come out. Both sides have a chance to challenge things in it that they do not like. Those come in motion. So we'll see some of the more controversial parts, like prosecutors could be like, no, it was worse than that. Or the defense can be like, no, it's way better than that. So we'll see a little bit of it trickle out. But that report itself is not a public record. It is for the judge. People are asked to write letters. It's come to my attention that P.G. Sittenfeld's letters are due pretty soon here. So we are getting very close to at least a date being set in P.G.'s sentencing because like this report, it's been going on for a little bit here. It seems like they're towards the end of that process.
So is this something that PG solicits, like letters from people?
Yes. I mean, yeah.
Like his fourth grade teacher.
Yes.
To say he's really a decent guy. Go easy on him. Is this what
that,
it is?
Yes.
So that gets factored into.
Yes. The judge will take those into account. And like everyone can write, you know. I expect so many letters in PG's case. You know, Tamaya Dennard had a lot of people write on her behalf of why she really shouldn't serve prison time and all of the good works that she did. And we heard some of that in court.
And she was, you know, I think that probably helped in terms of she didn't have to do the full term. She was released early. From all accounts, she was a model inmate helping with, you know, I think she was, what was she doing? She was teaching reading or she was,
yes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for, you know, serving the sentence, doing the time, putting it behind you. It'll be interesting to see what the next step is for Tamaya.
Well, Tamaya, as what the next we step know, is the CEO of a reentry program. That is something that we've seen.
That's right.
You know, my boss, Carl, does ask me all the time what PG's doing. I'm like, I don't know. He is keeping a very low profile. There's no social media posts. It's very, very low profile.
And all of them, they were, you know, released on their own.
They're free. Nobody's being held pending sentencing or everything. They're part of the community still.
So, okay. Well, this story's not finished yet, Sherry.
No, we're getting there, though, you guys.
All right. Well, let's hop on the streetcar.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I have with me sitting here today, I'm very excited to introduce everybody to Deputy Director of the Streetcar Services, Lori Burchett. Am I pronouncing that right?
Burchett.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. I'm kind of bad at that, you guys. I'm not worse than the council members during public comment for introducing people's names, but I should be better. But welcome.
Thank you.
We thought, you know what, the streetcar is a very popular topic, or at least it used to be on this podcast.
When this podcast launched, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, at least?
Oh, Burl, time blends together.
It does. It was during the, I would say, peak debate over the very existence of the streetcar. So it was kind of the, you know, the grist in the mill for the political discussions of the day. So it was a big topic on this podcast, but it's been a while since we discussed the streetcar.
It is. And you guys, we're not going to go really in that direction. This is not a political conversation today about the streetcar. You know, ridership is way up. We are going to talk about that because there's so much to say about it. And really, anytime you kind of look at the streetcar go by these days, you see people on it. So we're going to talk about that and where the streetcar stands today.
I'm ready.
Yes. Okay.
I am ready.
Lori,
and I have questions.
I'm ready.
Because I'm a streetcar rider. Let's put that
Me
up.
Me too.
Yes.
Me too.
Well, you kind of, that's an occupational hazard, isn't it? How often? That should be our first question. How often do you ride the streetcar?
Daily.
Okay.
So I am not only a proponent of the streetcar, I'm definitely a transit enthusiast. I take the Metro 12 from my house in Oakley every day in the morning, and I take either the 11 or the 12 back, depending on which I can get. So I do take the bus. We're a one-car family, so public transportation is really important to me and a huge value and part of my life. So when I do get to downtown, I will usually take the streetcar if I need to get up to the operations and maintenance facility. I'll also take it just to find out what's happening along the alignment. Is there anything that needs to be addressed? Any fixes we need to do? Any cleaning we need to do? What's the status? How do we provide a really good customer service? And part of that is the experience for people walking on. It needs to be clean. It needs to be safe. And it needs to be operating correctly. So I do take it every day. And then also on the weekends, if I'm visiting, my son loves to take the streetcar and say hello to all the operators. And
wait, how old is he?
He is 7. He'll be 8 next month.
Okay. I mean, honestly, one of my favorite downtown moments with my son ever is before the streetcar was built, fully built, we were crossing the street to get to Finley Market and the tracks had been laid. And he is like, is there a train? Where? He's like 6. Where's the train? I was like, well, we're building this. Just trying to explain to him. And it was kind of the height of the controversy. Mm-hmm. But I was like a transit enthusiast. And my husband's like, that's not usually how you talk about the streetcar. I was like, but to him it is. So, yes.
I think that's my main motivation to use it is getting to Finley Market from down here. Mm-hmm. It's just very easy. I would have to think that that has been a big driver of customers traffic to Finley Market.
Sure.
And not just, I mean, anyone along the streetcar line probably benefits, but I think I see a lot of people get off.
It's a very popular stop.
At that stop mm-hmm. and on.
Yep.
What other destinations do you think are drivers for streetcar usage?
Oh, absolutely. The banks is huge. We get some of our highest ridership on Bengals games and Reds games, and we opening day was huge. I don't know if you stop in to see the station after the game let out, but waiting for multiple trains. So lots of people filling up the trains on the way back to wherever they are going. And it could be to Findlay Market. Findlay Market is popular. All along the alignment, people are getting on and off as needed. The public library, Aronoff Center, also both popular. I get off at 6th and Main every day and then connect over to my bus. So that's one of my favorite stops, heading home. And just ridership is pretty consistent, but sort of those main large events is where we start to see those numbers tick up at different stations. And then if you're looking at like Blink, Washington Park was a huge destination during Blink and everything in OTR as well.
And that drove, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the record ridership
day
or weekend or...
Weekend, day, you take your pick. But in October 2022, it was our highest month ever with 103,700 rides.
And that was mostly driven by Blink.
Mostly driven by Blink. However, I will have this caveat because May, last month, was 102,189. And so that's pretty close to our highest, and we didn't even have a Blink. We had a Taste of Cincinnati, but it wasn't the same driver that Blink was.
Gotcha.
So we are starting to see that steady uptick in numbers.
So tell me, what does the director of the streetcar do? What's a day in your life, besides riding it to work?
So lots of things. Right now, I'm relatively new. I'm new to the area. I'm still learning about Cincinnati. But typically what I will do is learn more about the customer experience through comments and feedback. I'm constantly, replying to people, answering the phone if people have a question. I'm really hands-on and want to know what's happening on that system to try to make it a comfortable place for people. So I do a lot of that. I do a lot of reporting for the federal government. So we receive FTA, Transit Authority funding. And that with that comes a lot of verification, right? So ensuring that we are tracking what we need to track from a safety, ridership, budgeting, dollars, allocation of funds, where are those going? So making sure that all of that is right. And then I'm also ensuring that, we contract our services with TransDev for operations and maintenance. So ensuring that they have what they need in order to provide the service. So making sure that partnership is strong and listening to what they are saying to make improvements. And then I'm also trying to figure out how do we market and how do we have the communications? I think that that's been something that we're trying to get a handle on because we haven't necessarily been in a position. We're 6 years old, and so almost seven. And I think that just getting that grounding of making sure we have a state of good repair, our vehicles are in good condition and that we're maintaining them properly. And then the next step is going to be, how do we get the word out about the streetcar? Because it is an asset to the community, not only in OTR and downtown, but anybody that visits here. I get calls all the time saying, hey, I'm coming to Cincinnati for the first time, really want to take the streetcar. And so I'll find brochures, send maps, give information. I even talked to one woman that was visiting and she didn't want to use her car. So I'm trying to help her. Okay, you can take the 49 bus and you can transfer at the Aronoff Center and get to where you need to go around the city. So I'm really a huge advocate and trying to get the information out there to people.
So can you talk a little bit about what the mission is for the streetcar now and how we as a community should define success? Because I think that was part of the initial discussion, debate. Was it going to be a revenue generator? Would it pay for itself? It started out where you did have to pay a fare. Now it's free to use. I think it's sort of like many things. Once implementation starts, once you have the reality of how it's used and how it fits into the larger scheme of things, it's wholly appropriate to update the mission and and set the expectations. So, and I'm thinking way back to, projections for ridership, projections for revenue, and to where we are today, where we are actually saying, we are excited about record ridership days. We're seeing that it is part of how we connect people. on big event days downtown, but what's the daily usage? I'm just very curious, you know, at the end of the year, when we say, boy, it was a great year for the streetcar, what are those benchmarks?
Yeah. Great. Really good question. So I'm going to break this down just a little bit. So I can tell you my perspective and what I value is what makes this job really important to me is that I truly believe that transportation is a human right and that people should be able to have an option to safe, efficient, reliable transportation. It's the largest ability for people to have economic mobility. And so having that as part of the fabric of your community gets people where they need to go. And the mission of the streetcar, I will say, has probably changed. If you remember 2020, the pandemic hit and it changed how we operate as a society. And because of that, we're trying to figure out where do we go next? And one of the biggest things that happened that was affected by the pandemic has been public transportation. So public transportation completely dropped off in March 2020. And lots of markets now in a post-pandemic are not recovering at the same rate because it's been commute-based. People have been taking the bus and taking trains and things to get to their jobs. Now we're starting to see this trend where people are shifting to work from home, even if it's not full-time, a hybrid environment. Offices and buildings are not filling up again. I came here from Seattle. I was a transit planner at King County Metro for a number of years. And Seattle downtown is much different than it was when I first started there. And that's because Amazon is not bringing people back to the office. Microsoft is not bringing people back to the office. And our largest generator for people riding the bus was commutes. So that being said, where we have what the streetcar has that we didn't anticipate when we were originally doing projections is that we're not a commute-based. We are, people can take it anytime during the day while it's operating. We run the most service, the most frequent service on the weekends, which is opposite of most transit agencies because we're not going after that commute market. So what we're seeing is that we are one of the most growing transit agencies in the United States. So we are on a trend that is much more upward, and we're gaining ridership because of that. We didn't base our market on the commute trip, which nobody anticipated when we did our original 2007 assessment feasibility study.
Sure, yeah.
So the projections, I feel like at this point are, I'm not going to say absolute, but they're definitely different. And we now live in a post-pandemic world.
No, everyone has had to pivot, throw away projections, start anew. To plug some of the work we're doing here on downtown, the future of downtown, we had a big story about just what you're talking about, that downtown is no longer driven by workplace commuters. Mm-hmm. And it is right before our eyes evolving into a residential/entertainment destination. Mm-hmm. So what you just said tracks with that, no pun intended. Well, maybe it was slightly intended.
I'm here for it.
It tracks with that because if this is an entertainment destination, dining, you know, theater, sports, all the fun things to do downtown, and we are seeing office spaces converted to condos, apartments. What does that mean for the streetcar when that dynamic happens?
So I think it's a really positive thing for the streetcar. I think what's great about this system is that you can go and park anywhere near the alignment and get wherever you need to go. We're seeing that people are going to multiple destinations because they're not driving between places. So you park once, and then also it reduces our traffic overall. So it makes our street system much more efficient because people aren't taking those multiple trips. They're taking the one trip on the streetcar. It's also electric, so it doesn't have any emissions. It's completely emission-free. So that makes our climate downtown a lot more enjoyable without as much emissions around, too. So from a climate perspective, it's that helps out a lot. And then reducing traffic makes it easier for everybody to get around, and it makes it safer for you to be a pedestrian. So going to these different, you know, venues, dinner, you can walk to those places, and it's less congested, and you're able to utilize the streetcar if you need to go further. And it really connects the two communities too. We see a lot of people from that maybe are working in an office going up to Findlay Market. So it was great that you noticed that as well.
Or the Kroger on the Rhine.
Or the Kroger on the Rhine.
People come from all around the route can go to Kroger on the Rhine
and see lots
easily carry their groceries.
And I talk to people on the streetcar all the time and, you know, how do you use it? Or they start to know me, you know, regular riders and getting to know people that way. But it is definitely a valuable service for people.
Do the drivers sit up extra straight when you get on the bus? Do they know who you are?
I know all the operators by name and they know me and they know my kid.
I did want to ask you a little bit about the budget because it is budget time now. And we are pivoting. And so I just feel like that conversation, some people aren't being dragged into the change, the pivot of like what it is today compared to what it was. So it does look like the budget's almost $6 million, like coming up. But it seems like, so ridership is free now. So that's like those projections that never really lived up. That metric was a mess of like what the fares were going to bring in. But it does, like, what are the other revenue sources? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a naming rights partner anymore, is right?
No, we still do, technically. The contract is coming to a close.
When does that end?
So that ends this next, this year.
Okay.
So we are in the process of going out to bid for a new advertising contract. So that will be going out here relatively soon. We have one drafted. We get lots of inquiries.
I love when guests break news.
We get lots of inquiries about advertising. So lots of businesses and companies are reaching out. Well, how can I advertise on your system?
But it doesn't, I mean, honestly, it does not. I do ride the streetcar occasionally. It does not seem like there's a ton of advertising inside. Why is that?
We're coming to the close of our contract.
Okay.
And it's not being aggressively marketed from the contractors.
Okay. Space. And you are new, like, you know, from fall till now.
Yes.
Like, that's very new. Like, you do have to have time to assess things. So you think we'll have a different advertising partner to help with that?
It depends. We're going to go out to bid, and so we do a fair bidding process.
And to find the advertisers. Because now the eyeballs are on there.
It's to find a vendor to do the advertising sales, somebody that specializes in it. So I will clarify that we are revenue neutral. And let me explain that.
Okay.
Because
I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to be my hard hitting question.
Okay.
And you spared me the, you know, being the bad cop, good cop, bad cop. So
that's great. I'm glad I could come in here. So how a portion of our funding is federal grant resources, state grant resources, and we have some local grants. And how the federal government goes with awarding grants is that you are awarded your grant, but you don't actually get the money for another year. So what we have to do is that as a city, we have to incur those costs and then we reimburse ourselves. So at the end, when you're doing the ledger, it comes out neutral because we have that. We have our federal, state, local grant dollars that we have to incur the cost because we're providing a service and then we pay ourselves back. And so our intent during the budgeting process is to always stay even. It may take us a bit to catch up to it through how we are awarded those dollars, but that's what we do is we go after state, local. We have formula funds and those are allocated to us every year. We get money from the state for preventative maintenance. We get money from other granting sources to pay for our operations contract. And that is what we do during the budgeting process is to ensure that we are covering those costs. It might not look like it from how the money is coming in, but that's absolutely our intent is to stay neutral.
So there is no operating dollars going to the streetcar anymore.
So that's not entirely true because the operating dollars do have to pay for the services that we are incurring now.
Mm-hmm.
And then we reimburse ourselves. So if you looked at it, if we can take it, you know, 6 years into the future and you look at how the reimbursements came back, we are ensuring that we are staying neutral in the long term. So you are going to see operating dollars go to the streetcar, but our intent is to cover those costs through. And same with VTICA funds.
So that's a huge help to it, right?
The VTICA
is, I don't remember ever what that stands for, but it is the businesses along the streetcar route have all agreed if they get tax incentives from the city to pay a portion of those back to streetcar operations, since they're benefiting from the streetcar. And that was supposed to be a big revenue driver. We wrote a lot about it before it started. And it's like, here's what we think it's going to. But now we never write about it when all those dollars are running in. Mm-hmm. It did seem like a lot this year.
Absolutely.
I heard that number in passing.
Yep. So about $750,000, what was it generated. And just so that you know, it's voluntary tax increment contribution agreement, VTICA. And you're totally right. You explained it right on about you're getting a tax abatement as part of the community reinvestment area, and then a portion of that. So if you look individually at what the contributions are, collectively, it adds up, right? Because there are many more businesses and LLCs that are operating around the area, apartment buildings, and you're starting to see that number come up as redevelopment has been happening, which you've seen since 2016.
Is there any way that, so, I mean, to me, like, a long time ago, I got on board with the idea that it really is about the economic development along it, because I've just seen so much changes where it goes, and you just, over time, you see so much things built up, apartment buildings, businesses. Mm-hmm. Is there any idea, like any plans to start tracking that? There's never been good tracking of that. It's super frustrating because the Kansas City streetcar, a lot, like what we've modeled on, tracks it. And when we were at the beginning, we're writing about it, like every business there that builds is asked, is the streetcar part of your plan? Yes or no? And it's an easy answer, and they've always tracked that number.
Great question, and very topical, because we are working with our Department of Economic Development right now. We just brought up the conversation actually this week of, hey, is there something that we can, how do we look at the economic development that's occurred, and how do we understand what the benefit has been, right? I think that that's a really good question to ask. And I also think that it is a really important thing to know, because I am very data-driven, and I like to know what the numbers are, because I don't want to make any assumptions without having the evidence in front of me. So that conversation is happening. I mean, we don't have anything to put out yet. We don't have a timeline. Okay. But the conversation is definitely getting started, because that is really important to us to understand. And I did want to say one more thing about fares, because I think that that is always a good conversation, something to bring up. So when it comes to fares, there's a lot of cost that goes into collecting fares. There's a lot of cost that goes into ticket vending machines, the upkeep, how they function, the cost of them. And so what happens is you have to calculate how much are you collecting in fares, but what are you spending on fares? And that's called fare box recovery. And so that number is never... it depends on the agency. You have to have a New York City system in order to get that money back. And same with King County Metro. We never recovered a large number of our fares, even though it's the largest, you know, the one of the most successful busing agencies in the United States, because we also have fare enforcement. You have to pay people to ensure that people are paying their fare. And so when you start to look at the numbers, that what we generate through fares is not as much as
it costs to collect them. And it was also cumbersome for riders. So it was bad for the experience too, because it was a streetcar coming and then you're going to miss it because you have to buy it because you just want to run and catch
confusing.
It. And so that never proved to be a good model. And I do think that's been borne out, and it's, you cannot argue with that. Like, those fare boxes were not working.
That's what I understand too.
So talk a little bit about your decision to leave Seattle, come to Cincinnati, be the point person for the streetcar. What's that experience been like?
It's been really great. And I will say, I'm originally from Michigan, but I did go to Ohio State, go Bucks. And my husband's family is all from Southern Ohio area, so it's closer to family. I am able to take a drive to see my parents instead of get on a plane. And I think that when now that my child is 6, 7, 8, that became increasingly more important. And we wanted to make sure that we weren't moving him during the school year. And one of my friends reached out and said, I think you would be really good in this position for the streetcar services. And it wasn't necessarily on my radar, but as I've said, I'm a really enthusiast about transit. And I thought it was a really good opportunity. I love Cincinnati. We've been Bengals season ticket holders for a long time. My husband and his father split them. And we held on to them, which has really paid off.
Yes, it has.
Yes, it has. There are so many people that 4 years ago dumped them and they are regretting it.
And so we've been coming to Cincinnati for a number of years. I actually have a picture of me from like 2001, the first time I visited, and so much was under construction. It just looks like a completely different city. One thing that really drew me to Cincinnati, I do have friends here, and it's not completely flat. I think that like coming from the West, I really love the mountains. That's why we moved out there in the beginning. Good outdoor opportunities, lots going on for being adventurous. And I thought that Cincinnati offered that with also being a short drive to see our parents.
Burl and I love to talk about Cincinnati being a gem.
It really is. You know, people, when I worked in D.C., and people thought I was from Ohio, they're like, gosh, it's so like flat and bleak there. And I'm like, well, there are parts of Ohio that you could say that
very
about.
Very large state.
But not Cincinnati. You should come here and see it. And when they have, they do have that reaction. Wow, I didn't know it was such a interesting place. Mm-hmm. And you're right about the hills. If anyone's run the Flying Pig Marathon, you know that.
I did.
We got some serious hills here.
Did you run the whole marathon?
Ran the full marathon. Got soaked.
Congratulations.
Wait, and you still feel this way? Okay.
I do. It's still beautiful.
So, where do you see the future of the streetcar going?
We can't let you walk out of here without asking this question.
my dream would be
okay.
Like connecting Clifton and downtown. Mm-hmm. And I know that was originally when the plans were on the drawing board, that was, you know, like phase two, phase three or whatever, or even just, you know, this sets what we're doing now. I think that was the pitch. When people were looking at the original lines, it was understood at the time that this was step one. Like obviously this circle, there's more we can do. We can connect Clifton. We can do some other things. Is that still a realistic goal for the streetcar, or are we in the position right now of maximizing the lines we have?
I think that's a great question and a question I get often. So I think that's probably the number one thing that people ask about. And, you know, I'm relatively new in this position. My main focus right now is ensuring that our fleet is able to do what it needs to do and finding the resources to be able to make sure that that continues to happen. Preventative maintenance is a big part of the system to ensure it can continue to operate. So that's kind of my big thing. And then also improving the customer service. We're also going to be doing a rider, non-rider survey, understand how people are using the system. If people are not using the system, is there any barrier there? What can we do to improve the overall functionality, efficiency? What are those opportunities? And really understanding who's using the system and how we can improve on it. So that's part of it. And definitely, as I mentioned before, I think the market has really changed for everything, not just transit, but how people post-pandemic. And the original feasibility study was 2007, I believe. And as I mentioned before, a lot has changed from there. I think that the next opportunity, you know, really looking for direction from leadership, I think that's really important. And understanding what leadership is thinking and really looking to them to get some direction. But I would say just personally, as a transit planner, a feasibility study would be a logical step. But we don't have any funding set aside for that. That hasn't been in the conversation yet. But what we have been doing is ensuring that we're providing a really good product and seeing how we can improve on that. I think we have a really great contractor with Transdev. They have really improved like their efficiency and operations and on-time capabilities, which has been wonderful. And then their maintenance staff is actually incredible. Like they're kind of the unsung heroes because they keep everything running. They're really innovative and they do it at like a cost savings. So, I mean, really incredible
stuff. You mentioned preventative maintenance. I'm very curious. What are some of the typical things that you have to worry about in keeping a streetcar running?
Like
what breaks down? Like what's the What's the number one or two kind of maintenance issues?
Well, it depends. So what has been interesting, what I've been learning, and I'm not a maintenance expert, but what I've been learning is that there are certain components that break down based on maybe something is faulty within that part. So there's a lot of exploring when something isn't working. So if the compressor isn't working, well, why isn't the compressor working? And then our maintenance staff will go in there and they'll try to figure out and they'll say like, oh, there's a flap that isn't working on the compressor and it's letting in water and it's causing it to fail. I don't know. And so then they go through and they like create a sub for that. So, and one thing that's interesting about our system too is that they're a CAF vehicle. That's the manufacturer. And there are only 11 of these in the United States. Kansas City has some and we have some. And so when you're doing parts, nobody's making the same parts anymore. So ensuring that we have enough product available to make those small fixes to keep everything else running properly.
It's kind of like if you own a Ferrari.
Yes.
I've heard. I don't know. But finding parts. It's a great car, but finding parts. Oh, let me tell you.
Burl just compared the streetcar to a Ferrari. We're on the record. I do want to go back and ask you, first of all, that is your number one question. I get that question all the time, especially with all of the federal government money and the transportation money. Mm-hmm. They're like, what are you hearing out of City Hall? And I do have to say that expanding the streetcar does not seem to be priority number one. Does everyone at City Hall love the streetcar? Yes, they do. But it is not just when I hear about long-term plans. It's the convention center district. It's the decking. There's a lot of, it's the arena. There's a lot of things in play and it's never, we're expanding the streetcar tomorrow. That doesn't mean they don't want to, but I don't hear that. And so that's the question I get the most. I don't. But I do, I do feel like, and I'm sure everyone has the feasibility study sitting in their guest room like I do, like right next to their computer. Is that right? Like it's kind of at the bottom of the pile, but it is sitting right there. That and some stuff about the banks. Those are the bottom two documents. But anyway.
Those wild and crazy Coolidges.
Nobody wants to see
staying up at night reading feasibility studies. And
nobody wants to see Alex Coolidge's pile of papers, including me. But I guess if you're a business reporter, that's a thing. But anyway, we really would have to go back to ground zero, right? If somebody says we want to expand the streetcar, we need a feasibility study. It's not like we could just pick up the plans from way back when and be like, oh, well, it's going to cost $75 million to take it up Vine Street. Great, here we go. It does have to start from scratch, right? Pretty much.
I would say for us to really understand what the needs are, we would, and what has changed since 2007, we have new materials. We have, you know, I mean, there's like new construction methods. And so we would need to really understand like what has changed and what could be applicable.
And new venues downtown.
Absolutely.
Or new venues on the drawing right. board.
There's a FC Cincinnati soccer stadium and a brand new development coming up out of the ground in the West End.
Yeah, there's going to be this convention district. And when you talk about people from out of town that don't want to rent cars, very fascinating, very fascinating.
So if there is going to be an expansion, don't expect City Council to come in on a Monday, talk about it at Budget Committee, and then suddenly on Wednesday. If this were ever to happen, it would be a huge discussion. I just want to let people understand like how that would go. But I do, could you see, Clifton's the big question, obviously, but could you ever see like mini expansions? Taking it to the convention center, taking it to FC Cincinnati Stadium. Is that something that is ever kind of like thought about as like future plans? Something that isn't this huge expansion, but really helping around downtown?
Depending on a scope of some sort of study, those would be options that would be put out to you, right? And definitely we would need our leadership having some direction on that, to your point. But it just depends on what that scope is and what we feel like is going to be appropriate. But that part of the study is definitely something that would be a part of it. Like, here are the options, here are the costs, and then you do the cost-benefit analysis after that. And then, you know, finding a stream of funding to be able to support it, ensuring lots of questions around how would we do another maintenance operations facility? Would it be needed? Would we need to expand our fleet? What does that look like? And so like a study of that magnitude would need to look at a lot of different options.
Well, I have to tell you that even when I'm not writing it and it goes by and I hear the ding ding, it makes me smile. It is one of those things that I think, you know, you can argue about it from a political standpoint, but I don't think
it does
you can
have a distinctive sound. I think
even the harshest critics would have to say it feels right, you know, that we would have.
The harshest critics would not say that, but I agree with you.
You know, it just feels right, you know, like it's not the end all be all to our transportation challenges, but it does have, it has kind of matured into a very, like, if we took it away, people would complain.
That's
kind of my measurement of it.
So much
if
more
it, if you shut it down tomorrow, it would be a huge loss. And I think that's a, you know, credit to everybody that pushed the project forward. And it just kind of feels right for a city that has our amenities and challenges that's a piece of the puzzle. So that's my opinion.
Okay.
That's my opinion. Sherry has to report on this so she can't be as effusive in her streetcar.
I think it's enough to say I ride the streetcar.
There you go.
I mean, we park at the bottom. Like, my parking spot is at the bottom of the city in the south part. I have to get to the other parts. And
no,
it I don't want to pay like parking, you guys. At big events, I have never seen the kind of prices that we're seeing. $50 an event day, $60. Like, parking is really, I'm like, what city am I in? Mm-hmm. I'm sure in other cities it's probably even more than that on big event days, but it does raise an eyebrow.
Well, we wish you luck.
Thank you.
It was fascinating talking to you. I thought I knew everything about the streetcar, but I learned something today.
We haven't really written about it that much lately, except for ridership numbers. And you guys watch for a story. We're going to give you all these latest ridership numbers too.
And now that I know the naming rights are coming up, maybe we should make a run, Sherry, for the Cincinnati.com connector.
Oh, it sounds good.
Make a run for that.
Sounds good.
I'll have to talk to our marketing people.
Okay. At the very least, we could put an ad in it.
Maybe. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. This is great. It was really nice to talk to you both and share my enthusiasm for the streetcar and Cincinnati.
And you can feel it too. It's a good energy.
Great.
I love when guests break news. There was a lot of news there just about really where like all of the streetcar funding is going, what's happening with it. You could tell that there's like a really breath of fresh air.
She was smiling. Some of the questions we asked her,
there was really good energy.
Yeah, she was super excited to talk about what's going on with the streetcar. And yeah, we did learn some things, I think.
Yes. You know what we didn't ask her about, though?
What's that?
We had former podcast guest, I love saying that, Emilio Estevez is the voice of the streetcar. So if you're on the streetcar and you're like, who is that? It's Emilio. I was like, we should have asked her. Are they best friends or what?
You know, that'd be a good idea to do a story, because I think it's fun. Like when you walk through CVG, the airport, you hear the voice of Marty Brenneman reminding you, you know, don't leave your bag unattended and things like that. So the celebrity voice work that you might run into town. So we have Emilio Estevez is the voice of the streetcar telling you what the next stop is. I think that's pretty cool. All right. So did you have a Cincinnati moment to share this week, Sherry?
I did. Someplace that I should have been before and have never been before. After we had my dad over for dinner on Sunday night, and as I'm dieting, as most people know, follow me, like see me in City Hall, I'm dieting, I'm kind of boring. There's no more desserts at dinner. And my dad was like, why aren't there desserts at dinner anymore? I'm like, because... But you can cheat a little bit sometimes. And I was like, you know what we should do? There's this place called the Root Beer.
So pause for a minute. Sherry is dieting and the whole family has to suffer and not have dessert. That's how you run your household?
I mean, to be fair, not Jack.
Okay, Jack.
Not Jack, but he keeps
Jack, okay.
In his basement lair, there's Tate's cookies and Oreos. He'll come home. I'm like, get those Oreos out of my face.
So I know where this is heading now, because somebody had a sweet tooth, and man, doesn't a root beer float sound good right now?
It was the best root beer float. So we went to, again, I've heard about this for just so long, the root beer stand in Sharonville, and just had amazing root beer floats. And then everyone in my family had to listen to me. Alex was driving, and so I was like reciting the history of it.
It's a great place. It's open seasonally. They shut down for the winter. It's not too far from where I live in Blue Ash, so I can just pop on Reading Road and drive into Sharonville there. You can't miss it. It's painted bright orange.
It is.
And in a kind of industrial area, it is a oasis of fun and ice cream. And their cheeseburgers are outstanding,
I know,
too.
We should have eaten just – I did think while we were there, we should have just eaten dinner there.
Yeah, no, we look forward to the root beer stand opening up. Well, that's a good moment.
Two things about the root. Do you know why it's in such a remote area?
No. Why is it?
Because when it was first built, I think in the 50s, it was in a prime location on Route 25, which connected Florida with the North. Okay. And it was built – it was an A&W root beer to start, but once that franchise – they let go of the franchise name, then it just became a local place. But it was a very busy road because it's how you got to Florida. And then, of course, the highway system came through, and that's not how you get to Florida anymore, but no. It is. My dad was like, where are we going? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. And so that
is... What route did you say it was?
Route 25, I think.
Isn't it 42? Now you're looking it up.
All right, next week I'll tweet about it because I'll tweet all my pictures.
All right. Well, Reading Road, Route 42, Sharonville, you can't miss it. It's a favorite of the Love family too. So my Cincinnati moment was watching this city, especially the Reds fans, go bananas for the major league debut of one Ellie De La Cruz. And what did he do in his second game? He hit the deepest, longest home run of the year in Great American Ballpark. So people are going crazy. And I just love when the Reds generate excitement.
He also, didn't he hit the fastest ball thrown?
Oh,
like 112 miles per hour, right?
His exit velocity, just his batting practice swings where he's not swinging, you know, at his full capacity, are exiting at higher than 100 miles an hour. So, I mean, he's the definition of a phenom. I love when, you know...
Joe Burrow stopped by to see him.
Even Joe Burrow was fanboying a little bit over Ellie De La Cruz. And that led to a great Cincinnati moment in and of itself because Joe Burrow took batting practice.
He did.
He totally did.
The question at hand is how did the Bengals players get to the Red Stadium? Is there a secret underground tunnel between the stadiums? Did they walk through the banks? Was there a golf cart situation? Did they take the streetcar?
Well, as you know, now, so where we're sitting right now recording, we are overlooking Fort Washington Way, Paycor Stadium. If I move my head a little bit, I can kind of see the rest of the banks. There are underground parking garages.
That's true.
And
you could cut through there.
That's a great question.
You
can,
because I can remember once trying to park down there, like stupidly. And by the time I was done, I was like, why didn't I just park here? Because I was all the way at the Bengals stadium and walked through the garage.
Can you get from Paycor Stadium to Great American Ballpark underground?
You know what?
We will find out.
We are going to find out, and I'm going to pitch the story idea to one of my fabulous coworkers, Aaron Couch, who has been doing this series. You guys, it is awesome. It's like Ask Us Anything, and she's been answering just all of these random questions, and this seems like a good candidate for that.
I think so. All right. Well, that was the moment I loved for the city this week, that you had, you know, and not just the best prospect, the top prospect for the Reds, but one of the top prospects in Major League Baseball made the debut. And
someone else made their debut.
Yes, that's right. We welcomed our new Reds beat reporter, Gordon Wittenmeyer. And, you know, it's June. It's not really like you know, we're not scoreboard watching for playoffs. It seemed like maybe it was going to be a nice time to ease into the beat, but no. He's here for all of 1 week. Ellie De La Cruz gets called up. And Gordon was one of the only people to interview Joe Burrow yesterday as well. So this has been a big, if you're starting as the new Reds beat writer.
Yeah, no kidding.
and you have this story land in your lap and you get to interview Joe Burrow. I mean, I would be saying, hey, I came to a great place to work. This is fantastic.
I agree. I covered Jeff Pastor's hearing yesterday and wrote about the budget.
Well, we also had...
So there's something to be said for what he's doing.
We also had Cincinnati's top workplaces last night as we record this, which is great.
A lot of categories there, right?
144 local businesses were honored by their employees. Well, honored by the Enquirer and the top workplaces folks for being nominated by their employees for being a great place to work. So that was fun. But we had a photographer there as well who we're saying farewell to. That's Stephanie Scarborough, who was our intern extraordinaire. And I had to apologize to her because I said, well, you know, why we have a photographer at the, you know, at the Reds game covering Ellie De La Cruz, you're here doing a bunch of grip and grins with people getting plaques. It's like the worst thing, right, Phil? That's the worst assignment that a visual journalist could get, is doing those grip and grins. But
Phil was shaking his head, so at least it's not when I drag them all to City Hall to take pictures of council meetings.
Oh my gosh. All right, well, lots of Cincinnati moments this week. I think we got a podcast, Sherry.
And yes, we do, and we learned a lot today.
All right, thanks everyone.